Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Thursday the 23rd of July. Today, MPs say government interference was partly to blame for last year's SATS fiasco.
Let's have a system where you know what it is. It's either a government body coming from outside, inside government, or it's coming from an independent body that isn't full of observers.
Also today, voters go to the polls in Norwich North, the first by-election since the MPs' expenses scandal.
We assume the Tories are going to win. The Tories are a bit edgy about it. They think they're going to win, but not by very much.
And why more and more French women are covering up on the beach.
In recent years, it's become more tied in. It's had things projected onto it to do with desire, sexualisation of the body, and the body beautiful, the body perfect.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about that, let's have the news and the papers.
A national swine flu service aiming to speed up access to drugs goes live today. The telephone and internet service will be staffed by more than 1,500 people and could eventually run 24 hours a day. Meanwhile, Britain's biggest pharmaceutical company is preparing to sell £3 billion worth of swine flu drugs this year. GlaxoSmithKline says its vaccine could be available by September after the government placed advance orders for 60 million doses. Some of Britain's most prestigious arts projects are under threat because of a hole in government finances. The Department for Culture, Media and Sport faces a shortfall of up to £100 million. The scale of the problem could derail projects such as the British Museum's new exhibition wing and the Stonehenge Visitor Centre. The Culture Department's refused to comment. The office of Michael Jackson's personal doctor has been raided by federal drugs agents. More than 20 officers investigating the star's death searched the Texas office of Dr. Conrad Murray. Murray tended for Jackson after he collapsed last month in Los Angeles. The search warrant is reportedly connected to the autopsy on Jackson, which found traces of the powerful anaesthetic propofol. Stephen Gerrard is expected to give evidence in court today to defend himself against an affray charge. The England and Liverpool footballer told detectives after being arrested that he acted in self-defence. The trial at Liverpool Crown Court could finish before the weekend. Kevin Peterson will miss the rest of England's campaign to win the Ashes. The 29-year-old batsman's undergone surgery on his Achilles tendon. Ian Bell looks set to replace him for next week's match at Edgbaston. There are also concerns over the fitness of all-rounder Andrew Flintoff. Now for a look at today's papers, starting with the Mail. It reports that a group of English schoolchildren were treated like dangerous criminals before being kicked out of France for having swine flu. The Times gives its front page to the news that the Church of England's ready to make peace with cohabiting parents who are unmarried. The church is unveiling a joint ceremony that would allow parents to baptise their children as they get married. An editorial in the paper notes, single mothers used to be desperate for the church's approval. Now it seems the church is desperate for theirs. Education will be cut by £100 million after the next election, says The Telegraph. It claims the figures from the Treasury show spending will start to fall from next year. The Independent focuses on the closure of Britain's sole wind-powered turbine plant. It claims the government faces a credibility gap over green jobs. David Cameron's interviewed in The Sun as voters in the Norwich North constituency go to the polls in a by-election. He says he's ready to govern. Meanwhile, The Mirror claims patients may have to pay for hospital food under a Conservative government. The FT reports the new electrified train tracks are to be introduced between London and Swansea. And on the back pages, many of the papers claim that John Terry is poised to stay at Chelsea after rumours linking him with Manchester City. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The marking of last summer's SAT tests collapsed under the management of the American company ETS. The results were late, which led the firm to be sacked, the body responsible for monitoring the fiasco to be disbanded, and the children's secretary, Ed Balls, to scrap key stage 3 tests for 14-year-olds. But a report published today by MPs on the Children's, Schools and Families Commons Select Committee says government interference made it more likely that the test results would fail. It says exam bodies must have more independence and the freedom to make key decisions. The Labour MP for Huddersfield, Barry Shearman, chairs the committee.
This is this never-never world, isn't it? That, quite honestly, the lessons we learn from what happened last year is that if you're going to have a... if the government's going to do something directly and take ministerial responsibility for it, let them do it in-house. Let it do it from the department and be in control of it. Everybody knows they're in control of it. And if it's going to be done by an independent body, make that body totally, truly independent. Make the chair or the chief executive or director independent, minded and able to be to disagree with the government and tell the government that they're asking too much or doing something wrong or telling them to do something that they don't want to do. So, in other words, let's have a system where you know what it is. It's either a government body coming from inside government from a Department of State, or it's coming from an independent body that isn't, full of observers and, silent witnesses and all that. So our report is really about having clarity, because where you do get bad results is when you get a kind of a mix and a muddle of the two. So the evidence that we got is, yes, of course, there is no dreadful Secretary of State who evilly manipulated all this. On the other hand, there is not a Ken Boston, head of the Qualification Curriculum Authority, did it all on his own.
Do you think that Ken Boston was made a scapegoat for the SATS fiasco?
No, not a scapegoat, because there's no doubt that I always thought Ken was a very good public servant. He did the honourable thing. He said, yes, this has gone wrong under my watch. It was my responsibility. I was well paid to do the job, and we fell down in it, and I'm resigning. So, that's a very honourable position, and I don't think he was trying to escape. What he tried to say is, actually, I wasn't as free and as independent as I was, I appeared to be. And, there was an element at which, the Secretary of State and the Schools Minister were involved. We all knew that stories were running in The Guardian and in other papers about problems emerging. So the government and the department must have known about problems long before, the real up-face public meetings took place between the ministers and Ken Boston and his team.
The trouble is, the government's caught between a rock and a hard place, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it's accused of micromanaging. On the other hand, people are saying that they should have intervened and stopped the rot before the disaster happened.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we're not trying. There are no devils and angels in this. There is a muddle and a mix. And what we said, it's much better if government departments do what government departments do and do them directly and transparently, and independent bodies like, and this is a crucial time to make this point, because Ofqual is just now
Body that's replaced the
it's replaced the QCA, but much of the QCA is, and it's, the government tells us it's going to be independent. Well, it's going to be independent, it's got to be robustly independent, it's got to be able to have a leadership that is tough and the quality to stand up to government, and also it doesn't want loads of observers and other people flitting in and out from the department.
Barry Shearman, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/education. Also on The Guardian's website, Luke Harding reports from Chechnya on the human rights researcher Natasha Estemirova, kidnapped in the regional capital Grozny and found murdered in the neighbouring Ingushetia. guardian.co.uk/Russia. Lots of musicians tell Jude Rogers how to make the perfect summer pop single. guardian.co.uk/music to find out about that. And Damien Hirst pays tribute to the late author Gordon Byrne at guardian.co.uk/culture. Parliament's broken up for the summer holidays, and voters go to the polls today in the Norwich North by-election to choose an MP to replace Ian Gibson, who resigned over the expenses scandal. Julian Glover, our chief leader writer, says a lot of voters are angry about the way Gibson was treated by Labour Party managers.
Ian Gibson was a sort of slightly crotchety old MP for Norwich, but really popular in his constituency. He was occasionally quite rude about his own constituents, but they liked him, they trusted him. And there was a feeling he was singled out by Labour because he was a bit of a troublemaker. He was against the Iraq war. He wasn't really one of the popular people in the parliamentary party that governments like. So they said to him, you have to leave at the next election. He said, right, I'm off. We'll have a by-election. The people of Norwich rather resent having that forced on them.
And Labour don't really stand a chance in this election anyway, do they?
Well, all sorts of rumours are swirling around at the moment as to what's going to happen. And quite often with elections, you sort of know the result before it comes in. And this won't come in until tomorrow on Friday lunchtime, which is the first time ever in a by-election, so we don't get that late-night shock. Maybe that'll actually make the press worse for Brown, because people will be able to pick the story up in the newspapers on Saturday. But on the result, we don't know. We assume the Tories are going to win. The Tories are a bit edgy about it. They think they're going to win, but not by very much. Now, they could be lying, and they think they're going to win by miles, and then that'll be a surprise. Or they could be seriously worried. But if they are worried, who's going to come sort of from the pack to overtake the Tories? Labour may come third, may come fourth, might just come first, but nobody first, but nobody really believes that. The Lib Dems haven't had a great campaign, though they've got quite a strong candidate. And the other thing about Norwich is the Greens are pretty popular. Big centre for them, so could they come second? Could they even win? Maybe it'll happen. And UKIP knocking around as well. So it's a bit of a mess. Nobody quite knows what's going to happen.
And the Labour candidate's been struck down with swine flu.
Yes, poor old Labour candidate. People have been quite rude about him in the press during the campaign. Then the last few days, when you really want to be out there getting votes, he's got ill, so he must be stuck at home. Apparently Peter Mandelson came up this week from London to go and campaign, heard that the Labour candidate had swine flu, didn't want to meet any of the activists in case they'd been infected too, and headed straight back to London on the train.
Mandelson gets everywhere, doesn't he?
Yeah, so he got as far as Norwich Station.
Now, what's your assessment of the government's recent performance as Parliament begins the summer recess?
Yes, well, MPs are off on what everybody calls their long summer holiday, although lots will be trying to rebuild their reputations in their constituencies by working quite hard. Gordon Brown emerges clinging on. It's 7 weeks since he nearly lost his job when the dramatic resignations of James Pennell and other people. He survived that. He did a press conference yesterday which got tangled up in helicopters and whether he has given Afghanistan troops enough helicopters. He seems to think he has. Everybody else seems to think not. So he's certainly not out of the woods. There's no sense of him leaving looking quite strong, his opponents looking weak. There's generally a feeling of him having not changed, having not improved, learnt nothing from the crisis. His poll ratings are slightly worse than they were during the James Pennell resignation. Labour's really not doing well at all. Tories are coming up a little bit. They're picking up some of the other votes. So he does look like he's going to lose the election.
For the Conservatives, a danger of complacency?
Well, there will be if they don't win Norwich by-election. And that for them is the great test, because a year ago, David Cameron won a by-election in Crewe, which people didn't think at the start that the Tories were going to win, and they won it by miles. And so there was a great sense of energy in the party from that. Now it's just taken for granted that they're going to win this seat. And if they don't win it, or if they only just win, or if turnout is very, very low, there'll be a lot of pressure on the Tories. And there's quite a lot of grumbling on the Tory backbenches as they go off on holiday, just about the way he's run the party, the way he's run the expenses issue, whether they're being tough enough on cuts, whether he's getting distracted by Europe. So things aren't perfect for him either.
And a bit of grumbling if you're a long-term Lib Dem supporter, quite possibly.
Well, there's either grumbling or excitement that you've got a leader who's taking decisions, because Nick Clegg's been quite tough. He said lots of things that they would like, which are very expensive, they couldn't afford if they won power, and that they're just aspirations. They're not substantial policies, things like getting rid of student tuition fees or free care for the elderly, standard Lib Dem policies. So he's really stripped out huge amounts of policy documents. He's down to sort of three core tasks for the party. That is quite tough. It's quite impressive. But I think a lot of Lib Dems will be uncomfortable. They'll also be uncomfortable because they weren't allowed to vote on it. He just announced it. They like voting. They love it.
Julian, many thanks. Julian Glover. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, how a visitor to a stately home discovered a treasure trove of gramophone records.
I was interested because it was a white label, and so I persuaded the young lady on duty to go underneath the safety net.
But first, as Gordon Brown is again forced to defend the level of resources for UK troops in Afghanistan, the country's leader, Hamid Karzai, has problems of his own. Just a month or so ago, he was the clear favourite to win next month's presidential elections. But tonight, there's a televised debate between some of the contenders in the election, but not Hamid Karzai, as John Boone reports from Kabul.
He pulled out last night after weeks of uncertainty about whether he was going to make an appearance. I think there's always scepticism that he would appear, but just the sheer embarrassment of not turning up led some to believe, not least the producers of the television show, that he would indeed come and debate his record with the other two leading contenders in this presidential race.
What's the reason for pulling out?
Well, his campaign team has given a number of reasons, which do read more like excuses than anything else. They say that this debate should be covered by all of Afghanistan's TV and radio outlets, despite the fact that it's actually being broadcast by, you know, two of the most popular stations in the country, that they say every broadcaster should have the right to cover this. And they also question the political neutrality of this TV station. It's called Tolo TV. It's fairly controversial. It's run into problems before with powerful and influential people who've not been happy with its coverage.
Is Karzai expected to win this election?
I think there's a change in the air. The mood in Kabul has shifted considerably in the last few weeks. It had been the case that everyone assumed that this election was sewn up months ago when President Karzai succeeded in winning the backing of virtually every influential tribal and ethnic power broker in the country. There's a sense now that his campaign has been somewhat lackluster, that his this coalition of power brokers that he's gathered is fragile, if not fracturing. And also the other big question is no one really knows how Afghans will vote. Will they really turn out just on the say-so of, you know, their local former warlord or their, you know, ethnic or tribal leader? Or will they be a bit more independent-minded? And that's a big question that no one has a decent answer to, because there's been very little in the way of public opinion polling. And I think all that's certain about this election is the uncertainty.
There must be some nervousness in Washington as to the outcome of this election.
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, U.S. diplomats, along with almost every other diplomat in Kabul, had thought that Karzai would walk this. And initially there was some disappointment because there's been a lot of frustration with President Karzai's record. And there are certainly people in the U.S. administration who would like to see a new man in charge. So I think it depends on your point of view, what you think of Karzai. The big risk, though, is if he doesn't win, then they may get someone who's even more awkward to deal with, or may have his own set of drawbacks.
John, many thanks. For a generation of British people, a beach holiday in France was the acme of adventurous foreign travel, and it was made all the more exotic by what seemed a peculiarly French phenomenon of women taking their tops off on the beach. But nowadays, fewer young French women are sunbathing topless, according to a study by social historians. Angélique Chrysaphis, our Paris correspondent, explains why topless sunbathing has been more acceptable in France than in other countries.
Frivolous topic in France, as you might think. It's actually quite an important sociological phenomenon. Now, basically, topless sunbathing has become a symbol of French summers and a symbol of French beaches. Now, this came about after a big sort of battle in society in the 60s and 70s after May 68, when we were seeing sort of freedom and flower power battles all over the world. Now, in France, we had the educated middle classes on the one hand arguing that the right to be topless on the beach was a feminist issue. It was linked to women's lib, the sexual revolution, that women should be able to do what they liked with their bodies, where they liked. And on the opposite side of that, you had the clergy and family groups saying that nipples on display would terrify children and pervert a whole generation. Now, what happened is the French government didn't step in to ban topless sunbathing, and the law was very much left open to interpretation. So France became this symbolic country, so whereby there was a great sort of women's movement going on in the US, but you couldn't take your top off in the US, it was against the law, whereas you could in France, and it became a point of pride.
And what's the evidence that now sunbathing topless is going out of fashion?
Well, it's quite interesting, actually, because while it was on the one hand seen as a point of pride and a struggle in the 70s for women, it then became recently in a sort of, saucy postcard topic. And even the mayor of Saint-Tropez was a bit annoyed that it was being something that was likened to what was going on in beaches in her area. Now, what we've seen in the last few years and what historians have spent the last few months studying is the fact that younger women in France today are not doing it. They're putting the tops back on. They're putting, you know, shock horror 1930s, you know, full bathing suits back on. And this is for various reasons. I was talking to one historian about it, and he was pointing out a recent poll in which 24% of French women said they were actually disturbed by toplessness on beaches. Now, what's happened is, once toplessness was linked to, you know, the women's lib movement and freedom from society's restraint. But in recent years, it's become more tied in. It's had things projected onto it to do with desire, sexualization of the body and the body beautiful, the body perfect. So it's less about women feeling at ease with their bodies, but it's now become part of this harsh cult of the body beautiful. And younger women just aren't buying into that.
So is the sort of topless era over?
That's what French historians are saying, and it's also got to do with sunscreen and cancer and people wearing more hats and caftans and T-shirts and everything else on the beach. Now, it is over for some, but definitely not for the over 60s, because the French media have been going to test this out on the beaches, and they found that older women, the ones who fought that original battle, aren't giving in yet. But the younger generations, it looks like it's gone very much out of fashion.
Angélique, many thanks. It's every collector's dream to stumble across a cache of valuable and rare gramophone records in unexpected circumstances. Well, that's what happened to Jim Pattison when he was visiting Brodsworth Hall, a stately home in Yorkshire, from where The Guardian's Martin Wainwright reports.
I'm at Brodsworth Hall, which is an early Victorian mansion just outside Doncaster. It belongs to English Heritage now, and it's full of stories. It's supposedly, the family who lived here are supposedly the originals for the Jarndyce family in Bleak House, Dickens's Bleak House, who had the great legal case. But it's got another claim to fame today, which is that a very perceptive visitor was going around the house, and he noticed something. He's Jim Pattison, who's a retired, you're all sorts of things, technical editor, sound recordist, classical singer, and they all have a bearing on this. Because, Jim, could you tell me what happened?
Well, I'm a member of English Heritage, and I came to Brodsworth Hall as a normal day visitor. We went round the gardens in the afternoon. We came in the house, and we were walking through. First of all, we spotted the piano, the Broadwood piano. Yeah. And then we were walking along in the same area, and I spotted this record here. I was interested because it was a white label. And so I persuaded the young lady on duty to go underneath the safety net. We weren't allowed to go under it, but she went under, and I said to her, just tell me what it says on the label. And she said to me, it says, Bohème Quartet Act 3, sung by Caruso, Scotti, Farah and Giafora.
My goodness, the real thing.
Yeah, the real thing. And suddenly, straight away, I knew with that combination, it had to be one of the original white labels. So I went home, went on the internet, found it was made in 1908, recorded in America, found that a company had produced it on CD and ordered a copy from America, and that was my relationship. But that was the beginning, because the lady on duty said to me, she said, when visitors show an interest in anything in the house, we are asked to ask them, fill in a form and send it to the curator. So that resulted in an invitation to come here to look at the records and to do a new inventory. And in doing that, we found these gems.
And you have... Can you just tell me some of them here? I mean, you've discovered some really wonderful old gramophone recordings.
Well, the one at the top there is Enrico Caruso, of which, of course, he made many records. In fact, some people think that the gramophone... Some people say either the gramophone made Caruso or Caruso made the gramophone. But it's a bit of...
They helped one another.
So he's singing there. He's singing Ma Paris from Marta by Flotow. And things like that.
I just noticed here there's Pomp and Circumstance, famous...
Pomp and Circumstance, yes, no, that
with
one.
With Sousa.
There, that one there, Pomp and Circumstance, you see that? Mm. That's at the top there. That was made in 1904.
Good heavens.
That was only 3 years after Elgar wrote it for the coronation of King George the... No, King Edward the Seventh, wasn't
yes.
it? Edward
yes.
the Seventh.
And it says here, it's got the trademark is an angel drawing a circle.
That's right.
And that's lovely, the idea
it's
that...
It's called a scribing angel.
And the idea that a gramophone record was like a sort of heavenly
right,
sound.
That's right.
I'm with Caroline Carr Whitworth, who's the custodian of this mansion. And Caroline, has this happened before, that you've had a visitor who's unearthed something that English Heritage, with all its expertise, hadn't perhaps realised it had gone.
Well, we have had a number of visitors actually over the years who've just commented or added to our knowledge on things, and we're always really, really grateful actually. I mean, we've learnt a lot, for example, about our taxidermy specimens, that they're by a Doncaster taxidermist and so on. So we're always glad to benefit from people's knowledge, and certainly Jim's knowledge. You know, we couldn't have done this exhibition without him.
And you've got a great little exhibition here showing pictures of the extraordinary gramophones, and downstairs they're actually in position in the South Hall, and people can look at the original records themselves, although I think probably they're not played anymore. Presumably they're the actual original.
No, we've put a number of the records on display. Jim did actually take the recordings that you hear directly from them, and that's why they sound crackly and antiquated, is not just that they're historic recordings, but also their records that have had, 50, 100 years of use in the family.
Well, so the motto is, if you're a specialist in anything and you're going around an English Heritage property, or indeed a National Trust one or any other one, keep your eyes peeled and don't be embarrassed to ask if you or one of the staff can nip over the railings.
Martin Wainwright reporting. Guardian Daily was produced today by Peter Sale and Phil Maynard. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.